This continues, lest it come to scandal, the genesis of Jewish kingship, from Lot and his daughters to Judah and Tamar and the Book of Ruth. This is the seventh tape in the series.
How could you leave that behind? Not let us know that. What I'm going to argue is maybe Abraham was the founder of monotheism. Maybe he wasn't. Actually, you could argue that there were other monotheists before Abraham. Adam was a monotheist. Noah was a monotheist. Right? Shem was a monotheist. There were lots of monotheists, right? You can't really say he was the founder of monotheism. Now, you might say he was the founder of monotheism in his time. Could be. Maybe it was forgotten until now. But still, that was not the most impressive thing about Abraham. How do you know? Because the Torah doesn't tell you that. It must have been there was something else that was even more impressive. What was that? Lech Lecha. If we're introduced to Abraham at Lech Lecha, that somehow has got to define what's so special about Abraham. What's so special about Abraham is Lech Lecha. What does that mean? So let me make this very plain and clear to you. Why is Lech Lecha so special? Let's talk about that for a second. I think that we actually do Abraham a disservice when we think of him as so wonderful because he's the founder of monotheism. Because you know what that makes him? That makes him into a wonderful philosopher, and that's it. He was a very good philosophical ivory tower guy. He could figure out that, you know, that really idolatry was wrong. Now, it's good to be a philosopher, right? But we don't sit and enthrone Leibniz, and we don't sit and enthrone Newton, and we don't sit and enthrone... These people are not theological role models. They take something more than just the philosophical recognition of something. Indeed, Bertrand Russell was a wonderful philosopher, but nobody thinks much of him. Right? He was the guy that had an affair, some say, with a woman in his class, and then was confronted with the morality of it all, said, and if I was teaching geometry, would you expect me to be a triangle? Right? Just because you can be a philosopher doesn't mean that you're a great person. And even if you're the discoverer of monotheism, doesn't mean you're a great person. But if you answer to Lech Lecha, you're a great person. Because what is Lech Lecha? Lech Lecha is monotheism in action. In other words, if someone comes to you, and imagine for a moment that you were in Abraham's shoes. Let me give you the following analogy. Let's say that one day, just to give you an understanding of what this was like, let's say that one day you woke up in the morning utterly convinced of the philosophical truth. With your whole soul and being, you know that this is true. But it's a very uncomfortable philosophical truth. I'm going to give you something ridiculous, but let's just go with me for a second. Let's say that one morning, after a feverish night long in your study, working out the philosophical ramifications of things, you come to a startling but very troubling conclusion that the truth is with the Maharishi Yogi in Tibet. Okay? And right, you think it's true, the Maharishi Yogi. Now you have a choice. You now believe that the truth in life is with the Maharishi Yogi in Tibet. What are you going to do? You have two options. Okay? Option number one, followers of the Maharishi Yogi grow their hair long, wear them in ponytails even if they're men, put on white robes, dance around with incense in funny ways in the airport, handing out brochures trying to proselytize people. Okay? They go on pilgrimages 3 times a year to Maharishi Yogi in Tibet, giving up all of their life savings to be able to sit in an incense-filled room in a lotus position that hurts their legs to listen words of inspiration in Hindi from the Maharishi Yogi. Okay? Now, you have a choice. You live in Baltimore. You have a wife and kids or a husband and kids, 2 cars, kids and TA, you know, that you're part of the steering committee of your shul's drive, and you've got, you know, you do volunteer Meals on Wheels, you're a respected person in the community, thank God you make a nice living, okay? Now you have a choice. Choice A, grow your hair long, put on the robes, go in the airport, start doing the dances, right? And your neighbors will come and ask you, how come you're going to Tibet tomorrow? What's this plane ticket I saw on your windowsill? Well, you know, in the middle of the night, I kind of, difficult to explain, but what are you going to say? I mean, was that you in the airport the other week? I mean, what were you doing with those robes, right? Okay, so this is option A, right? What's option B? Option B is, okay, in my heart of hearts, the whole Maharishi Yogi thing, it's really the truth, it's wonderful. But look, I'm not going to change my life, right? I mean, I'm happy here in Baltimore. I got my wife. Fine, philosophy's philosophy. We'll put it right there on the top shelf. But I've got a life to live, right? Yeah, maybe I'll write the Maharishi Yogi once or twice and tell him how impressed I am with his teachings. You know, but we'll leave it at that, okay? That is the great choice that every follower of a philosophical law, if you believe in God, it's not just a philosophical commitment to some truth. God is a being with whom you now have an obligation to have a relationship with. He's your creator. You've got to establish some relationship with this being. You can't ignore your creator. You have obligations towards your creator. Now, what are you going to do? Deal with it now. You believe that it's not about idols, that it's about a creator. There's now someone that you have to build a relationship with. What are you going to do? Now, everyone thinks you're crazy. They're all worshiping idols. You're the crazy monotheist in the room. You're the one with the incense and the lotus positions. Everyone thinks you're absolutely nuts. One God? You're crazy. A relationship with one, what about these idols, right? You have to have, and now this God tells you, leave it all behind, break all of your social bonds, trade in the wife and kids, the whole thing, you know, your honorary membership in an idolatry society. Leave it all behind to start on this very lonesome path of dedication to me and my relationship. It's an ultimate dedication. It's complete loyalty, complete dedication to the needs of another being. That is what chesed is really all about. What chesed is really all about is seeing another person who I'm in a relationship with and seeing my obligations towards that other person and giving towards them. It is monotheism in action. It is acting on monotheism. That's what makes Avram great. Not just that he came to some philosophical recognition in his mind, but he had the courage to change his life and to orient himself, giving what needed to be given away from his own selfish desires, orienting himself towards the need, so to speak, of another being of God and fulfilling those needs the way that needs to be done in a relationship. That is what we call love. And that is what chesed is about. That is ultimately love. What love is when I'm able to turn away from my own selfish world and able to orient myself to what your needs really are, irrespective of my needs. So as long as I relate to you, see, I can seem to have a loving relationship with my wife, but it can masquerade as love but not really love. If I think that she has a great sense of humor, so she cheers me up when I come home, if she likes my jokes, if she appreciates my whatever it is, if she, whenever I'm down, she picks me up, she makes food for me when I get home. All this is about me. It's about what she does for me. It's servicing me. I'm not really in love with her. I have someone who is very convenient to be in a relationship for because she ministers to all of my various needs, whether it be they emotional or otherwise. The real question of love, and I grant you it's hard to do, but love at its highest level, at its most pure level, which is very difficult to do, is to actually love someone for who they are, not just for what it is that they do for you. To love her because she is who she is, and through trial or thin water, sometimes, you know, even when she doesn't look pretty in the morning, to love her for who she is because I'm in a relationship with her and I need to do that for her. That is what love is. It's unselfish attention in that kind of way. It's recognizing another's needs, and then not just recognizing something about the other, because I can recognize philosophically all I want that my wife is an object worthy of love. But that's not love. If she comes and picks my brain and see, oh yes, yes, sure, he has this wonderful thought that he thinks that I am someone that he should love, that is not love. Love is action. Love is philosophy in action. Love is, and now what are you doing for her? How are you relating to her? Are you really going beyond yourself? Are you putting this into action in real life? That is really what love is about. Love is recognition plus. Abraham had recognition of God, but he had to move beyond recognition of God. He had to move from that into Lech Lecha. When he did, it was chesed. And it's no coincidence that he acts with chesed towards everyone. Because when someone is suffused with something, it infuses all of their relationships. The relationships with God and man. Usually you find people, by the way, who have difficulties with their relationships with people, oftentimes have the same difficulty with their relationship with God, and vice versa. Because God is just another being with whom we can relate. Yes, he's the master of the universe, but he's with a being with whom we forge relationships. The same way we forge relationships with human beings, to some extent that will reflect itself in the relationships we form with God. If chesed is how I relate towards God, chesed is how I relate towards people. I am someone who can be a Baal chesed. I am someone who can love beings outside of myself with whom I have important relationships and relate to them as ends in and of themselves, not just how they serve to me. I am a person who can not just philosophize about my obligations towards someone and understand the existence of someone and recognize that, but can act upon that, and that the acting of that is chesed. So therefore it's no coincidence that who are the great Baalei Chasadim in the Torah? They happen to be the great converts in the Torah. They are the people who could leave it all behind, who could say goodbye to all of the selfish motives and dedicate themselves to the needs of another as they see, who can really be loving in that kind of way, who can be full in themselves, not needful in themselves, and very happy with themselves, and then able to move on to the other and to pay attention to their needs. And now we come to what the book of Ruth, I think, is really all about, to tie it all together. It is even greater than your first chesed. Why is Yibum such a great chesed? Yibum is the ultimate selfless act. It's selfless really for two reasons. One reason is because of the recipient. The recipient is dead. As the Torah says, chesed for dead people is called chesed shel emet, the real, only truthful kind of chesed there is, because there can never, ever be hope of repayment. You're so dedicated to someone that even in death, even when they are no longer here, you remain loyal to them and wish to do right by them and your relationship with them. And yet it's also selfless on another level. It's selfless not just because of the recipient, but it's selfless because of what it is that the giver is giving. It's the giving of the most precious thing that I have for you. What is the most precious thing that I have? It's my body. It's my womb. For the man, it's his seed. It's his child. What could be more you than your child? It's the giving of, it's someone who feels secure in themselves to such an extent that I know who I am and I know that I'm real and I'm not diminished by giving some of the most precious things of what I have. There's enough to go around. I can give this to you and it won't destroy me. You have to be intensely secure to be able to do that. Onan can't do it. Onan is worried that if he does this, he'll destroy himself. Vayeda Onan ki lolo yazera. Onan knew it wouldn't be his, and therefore he destroys this child rather than allows it to come to fruition because he can't bear the thought of him doing it. Ploni Almoni is the Onan character in this story. In Ruth, there's also someone who's even closer to Boaz who could do Yibum. Guess what his name is? Ploni Almoni. And Ploni Almoni decides that he doesn't want to do Yibum with Ruth. Why? You know what he says? Because if I buy the fields of which have to go along with it, I would have to buy the fields of Elimelech and marry his widow, I'm worried, pen ashchit et nachlati, lest I destroy my own heritage, either my own child, by not having it be my own child, or my own lands, ancestral lands, because I won't be able to take care of them. Again, what is he worried about? That there's not enough to go around. I'm not secure enough of myself. I don't have it all together myself. If I overextend myself by reaching out in a selfless way for you, then I'm gone. Then I have nothing anymore. Right? That is what he's worried about. People like Ploni Almoni are not Balei Chesed. You need to be ultimately secure that I won't diminish myself by doing this before you're able to do that. And Ploni Almoni can't do it. The irony, of course, of Ploni Almoni is, guess what his name means? In the Talmud, whenever you want to refer to someone as Mr. Anonymous, you call them Ploni. Okay? Ploni Almoni is Mr. Anonymous. He becomes the symbol of anonymity. Mr. Ploni, who's so concerned about his legacy that God forbid he should give his child to be able to help out another man in surrogate fatherhood because God forbid he should disturb his own legacy, becomes the symbol of anonymity for time evermore, has no legacy whatsoever. And Ploni, by the way, quotes Onan, pen ashchit et nachlati, lest I destroy my own heritage. What did Onan do? He was batishachet arza. He destroyed his own seed. It's the same word. It's taken from Onan. He's the Onan character in the story. So what you have here in Chesed is the ability, the strength to understand that I'm not going to destroy myself by reaching out to you. That it's a great strength, by the way, and that is the great test of love. I think what is it that holds us back from loving, it strikes me? Why is it that we can't love? Why is loving such a difficult thing? It's because we're worried that there's not enough to go around. I'm worried that if I lavish attention upon you, then I'm not taking care of myself anymore. There's not enough for me. It's only if I feel that there is enough for me, I'm okay, I'll make it, I'll be fine, that I can then have the security to say, and now I can really, really pay attention to you. And that is what Ruth can do, and that is what Avram can do. And that's what you can do if you're in a loving kind of place. Okay, what do we have in this story, putting the entire story together? We have the following thing. And with this, I'm going to wrap up. There's a strange thing that happens in this story. Let me ask you the following. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment, if I can. And here's the devil's advocate question I'm going to ask. I'm going to challenge the kashrus of Ruth's conversion for a moment, if I may be so bold. And I'm going to argue that Ruth was an insincere convert. Okay? We all know that if you convert to Judaism, you have to be sincere. You have to really be attracted to Judaism. But I'm going to argue, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment, that Ruth's conversion should be invalidated on grounds that she was insincere. She was not really attracted to Judaism. We know, for example, that if someone wants to marry someone and just converts for the sake of marriage, that's not really a kosher conversion because they're attracted to the person and not attracted to Judaism. Let me ask you the following question. I'm going to make that argument about Ruth. What is Ruth really attracted to? Look carefully at her language when she says she wants to go back. What does she say? Who is she attracted to? Naomi. She says, I'm attracted to, I want to go wherever you go. I'll be with you. I'll be with you. I'm going to argue, invalidate her conversion. She was in love with Naomi, not the Jewish religion. That's the end of Ruth. But Ruth is the paradigm of a convert. Ruth exemplifies conversion. But this conversion, how is this conversion? She's attracted to Ruth. She's not attracted to Judaism. What's the answer to that question? Here's what I would propose. Look at the way Naomi is really attracted to Ruth for a moment. Ruth is attracted to Naomi. Read those words. This is not a normal attraction. This is such an intense attraction you wouldn't believe. Listen to these words. You don't say these words about just anything. She says the following. She says, Ki tachna shuv la'amech, I'm going back to you with your people. She says, Ki el asher telechi elich, where you go, I will go. Basher talini alin, where you sleep, I will sleep. Amech ami, your people is my people, v'elohayich elohai, and your God is my God. There's the religious part of it. But the religious part is part of the system, right? Basher tamuti amud, where you die, I will die. V'shamek aver, and there I will be buried. Ko yasher v'ko yosif, thus may God do for me. K'amavad yafri b'ni u'b'necha, and it will be only death that will be able to separate us. What is she really saying here? She's not talking about just liking somebody. She's talking about a far deeper relationship. Who is Naomi really for Ruth? What kind of person do you say these words to? What kind of person do you say, no, I must be with you. I must go where you go. I'll sleep where you sleep. Your people is my people. Your God is my people. Nothing comes between us but death. Very few of us have relationships like that with anybody. But the precious few of us that are zocheh to have a relationship like that to someone with whom we really ought to have a relationship like that, it's a very powerful thing. What kind of relationship is this? What English word would you use to describe it? Who is Naomi for Ruth? How could you say such a thing about a person?
Like her soulmate?
It's more than her soulmate, because she's not an equal in her eyes. She is her mentor in the deepest possible way. That's who Naomi is. You only say someone like that to a mentor who what is a mentor? Let's talk about what a mentor is. Asei lecha rav, make for yourself a mentor. What does it mean to really have a mentor in the world? Why is a mentor so important? What is a mentor? What's so great about having a mentor? So let me suggest this to you. In life, hopefully we have goals. And if we're spiritual people, maybe if we're lucky, we even have some spiritual goals, which we're striving for in life. Some places which we'd like to get to come 10 years from now, come 15 years from now. But let me ask you a question. How easy is it to reach those spiritual goals? What do we say to ourselves? When I grow up, you know, I would like to be more kind. I think I would like to be more noble in my relationships. What's the problem here, folks? Hopelessly abstract. I mean, you know it. You've lived long enough to know that those kinds of goals are so hard to achieve. When you're young, you can fool yourself into thinking that maybe next year I'll be more noble. But after you've tried that a few Yom Kippurs and realized that you're not so much more noble than last year, you start to give up on ever really being more noble. I mean, what's the problem here? I mean, you tried to be more noble, but the problem is that there's such a gap between just the philosophical abstract idea of what I want to be and the blood and guts work of actually actualizing that. There's such a chasm between those two things. It's not enough to just conceptualize what it is that I want to be. There's a bridge, though, between those two things. And the bridge between those two things can be a mentor. What does a mentor do? If I am lucky enough, and those few of us who can find this, who really are lucky enough, to find a really good, solid, healthy person, what does a mentor really mean? To me, my definition of a mentor would be the following. And it's an amazing thing to have one, and not everybody has one. But a mentor is somebody who you can look at and say, that's where I want to be 15 years from now. It's not just, in 15 years from now, I want to be more noble. I want to be more kind. No, I want to be like that. There it is, living flesh and blood, a person who embodies those traits, not in the abstract, but concretely. There it is, right before my eyes, concrete. And what happens if you find someone like that? If you find someone who literally embodies where you want to be 15 years from now, You can't let that person go. He doesn't even need to know he's your mentor. You don't even have to tell him he's your mentor. You need to watch him. You need to emulate him. You need to learn what makes him tick. You need to learn what makes him get up in the morning, how he goes out of the day. You have a precious resource there, someone who you can model your life after. To such a person you say, where you go, I go. Where you sleep, I sleep. Your God is my God. Why your God is my God? Because whatever makes you who you are is what I want to be. If part of what makes you who you are is your relationship with God and your people, then I have to be part of that, because that's you who are who I want to be. Are you an insincere convert? No. You're the most sincere possible convert. You're attracted to Naomi because of who she is, because she is who you want to be. Part of who she is her relationship with God, is her people, is her God. So you want that for yourself because she is who you want to be, and that's fundamental to who she is. You're not attracted to just some abstract concept of Judaism. No one knows who knows what Judaism is before they get involved with it. How could any convert know what it is? What do we do? Mixas kalas v'chamuras. We teach them a little bit about some of the strict laws, about some of the little laws. They know what it's going to be like. You don't know what it's going to be like. You live it for a few years. You know what it's going to be like. They don't know. They can guess. And that's enough to convert the abstract concept. If you really had a mentor who was flesh and blood living it, then you're really a convert. You know this is, you understand through him, this is what you want to be like. That is Ruth. Ruth is attracted to a living embodiment of Judaism, and she wants that. She's the most sincere convert of all. Okay, now what happens later on? I want you to listen to what Ruth says to Boaz. Ruth says to Boaz the following thing. When Ruth finally says, I want you to marry me, to Boaz, that night, that fateful night when she sleeps next to his feet, she says the following thing. The man shakes, vayacharada ish, he shudders when he realizes she's there. Hine isha shachevet maglotav, there's a woman sleeping at his feet. Vayor mi'at, who are you, she says. By the way, what does this remind you of? I don't know what to make of it. Where do we have a case where vayacharada ish, a person tremblings and says, who are you? Yitzchak, and the Medrash makes the connection. The other time that we have Vayecharad, someone trembling, and then says, who are you, right? So it's Yitzchak, there seems to be a connection there. I don't know what to make of it. But anyway, that's what he says. And he says, there's a woman standing next to her feet, and he says, who are you? And she says, Anochi Rut Amatecha. That's fascinating, actually. I just thought of what the connection might be. Where does that evil train of Hakara start? A false Hakara start? It starts with Yitzchak, doesn't it? It starts with the deception of Yitzchak. When Yitzchak trembled and said, who are you? And Yaakov lied. And it was revealed that Yaakov wasn't who he really was. And it was really Esav. It's finally coming full circle. The train of Hakara is ending here. It's ending in the same kind of story. Another person trembling and saying, who are you? But Ruth doesn't lie. She identifies who she really is and puts it on the table. And instead of forcing Boaz to do... No, it's because Ruth has a choice. If Ruth wants to, she can lie about who she is, she can dress up like a prostitute, she can deceive him, she can play the Yaakov game, so to speak, but she doesn't. She says, I'm me, and I'm putting the ball in your court, which is what Yaakov could have done, by the way, in that story with his father. He could have also gone to his father, instead of deceiving him, where the father had to tremble and say, who are you? He could have just said, Dad, I want the blessing. I need a blessing from you. I want you to give me a blessing. And maybe that could have worked. And if you look carefully at that story, by the way, it seems that that's what Rivka had in mind. Rivka never actually said to deceive him. Rivka just said, go to him and tell him you want a blessing. He then says, maybe I'll look like a trickster. So she then says, all right, fine, so deceive him. But the original plan was just go and tell him. He chooses otherwise, and the terrible train of false Hakara starts. It starts there, and he deceives his father. Then, in tit-for-tat fashion, he himself is deceived by the brothers when they too fool him in a case of Hakara. When they say, Hakerna, recognize, please, the cloak. And then the brothers, having done such a terrible thing and fooled their father, so Judah is now subject to the deception of Tamar, where Tamar then comes back with him the cloak and says, do you recognize the cloak? But Judah is able to redeem that recognition, to start things on the upswing, and to able to come to a difficult recognition. And in this story, the final redemption is full circle, when not just the... In other words, it's almost like there's a chiastic... There's four different recognitions. Train of recognition starts with Yitzchak and Yaakov. The first false recognition leads to a worse false recognition as a result of that, which is the deception of involving Yosef. But there's a possible redemption of that, which is the Hakerna of Tamar, which redeems the false recognition of Yosef. And then we go back to redeeming the final recognition, which is redeeming Yaakov's false recognition, when someone has an ability to deceive someone about their identity and instead doesn't and puts the ball in his court the way they're supposed to and says, but now recognize me for real, right? And that's what she says, I am Ruth. You can recognize who I am and act upon it. And what does she say to him? And then she says these words. She says, I want you to marry me, but the word she chooses was uparasta knafecha alamatecha. I want you to spread your wings over you, over me, over your maidservant. And it's a euphemism for marriage. What does he mean, spread your wings over me? Where does she get those words from? Interestingly, if you look earlier in Ruth, Ruth is quoting from an earlier point. Ruth is quoting from something that Boaz said. Because Boaz had used this language of spreading wings. Do you remember where? When Boaz had first met her and had been impressed with her, he had said, I'm very impressed with your chesed. May God bless you, and may you find blessing from the God under whose wings you have sought repose. Asher batallah chasot tachat knafav, you've come to find repose under his wings. Isn't it interesting that Ruth, later on in the story, should say, I want you to spread your wings over me. He said, I want you to find blessing under the wings of God. She says, no, I want you to spread your wings over me, not God's wings. What is she really saying? Here's what I think she's saying. What makes Ruth tick? It's always dangerous to analyze a biblical personality to find out what makes them tick, but throwing caution to the winds for a moment, what makes Ruth tick? What is she about? Ruth is a woman who's attracted to Naomi. What attracted to her was a living, breathing embodiment of Judaism. What makes Ruth tick is not just recognizing something, but acting upon it. Chesed. If I understand that I have an obligation towards my husband, I will act upon it and devote myself selflessly towards it. If I understand that I have an obligation towards God, I will convert and I will be part of it and devote myself selflessly towards it. I will devote myself selflessly towards my mother-in-law. There's enough to go around. There's enough love to go around. Who am I attracted to? My mother-in-law. Who is she? She's a woman of action too. She is a concrete embodiment of Judaism, and it is Judaism lived not just in thought, but indeed in Naomi that attracts me, and that concretely attracts me. She's a concrete woman who is motivated by concrete acts of chesed, and that's what makes her tick. It is not just the intellectual recognition of something, it is the action. What happens with Boaz? What happens with Boaz is that Boaz looks at her and sees who she is and recognizes her. He has hakara. He, after all, is the son of Peretz, the son that is born from Yehuda in that great act of hakara as Yehuda. And just as Yehuda had the ability to recognize an imbalance, so too he has the ability to recognize an imbalance. He looks at her and says, oh no, you want to know why matzati chen lahakireni v'anochi nachriya? You want to know why I found favor in your eyes to be makir you, to recognize who you really are? No, no, you're not some little low-life. You're above me. He has that ability of Yehuda for hakara, but then he drops the ball. What would be the logical stage to go next? He knows who she is. He knows why she came back. She came back to try to find a husband from this family. He's from this family. He could offer to marry her, but he doesn't. He stops short. He recognizes her, right? Much like Yehuda, his father, who stopped short once before in selling Yosef, knew the right thing to do, but didn't go the full way. Boaz also knows the right thing to do, but doesn't go the full way. He understands the moral construct over here. He looks at her and he says, you're wonderful. I can be makir you. I recognize who you are. But then he stops and says, may God bless you, and may you be able to find repose underneath his wings. Very nice. The problem is that he has it within his own power to give her what she needs, and he's not doing it. He says, may God bless you. And she waits and waits. She waits until when? He says, you can stick around me until the end of the harvest, until the chala, until the end of the harvest. And slowly the time of chala comes, the time of finishing the harvest comes, and the harvest is over, and time's up, and nothing has happened.
And the question is, which kala is it going to be? The kala of destruction, or the kala of bringing to fruition? And it reminds us of another time, when the time was up, and nothing had happened. A time many centuries ago, when another woman had waited for Yibum, and had waited and waited, and nothing had happened. That woman was Tamar. And at that time, Tamar had taken upon herself. She saw no other way, so she deceived Judah. She dressed up, and she made certain that unknowingly he would bear her child. And now, once again, a time is up, and a woman selflessly dedicated to the memory of her dead husband once again faces a choice. And this time she again goes to a man, and you expect, it almost seems like the same thing is about to happen. As if you read the story of Ruth, it seems as if a seduction is about to happen. She goes to him in the middle of the night, she comes to him, she sleeps next to his feet, and it's the seduction that didn't happen. It's Yehuda and Tamar waiting to happen all over again, but instead of seducing him, she stops, and he wakes up in the middle of the night. Vayecharad charada gadola. And he trembles a great trembling, the same words as Isaac, except those were the words of Isaac after he was deceived. And these are the words of Boaz when he could have been deceived, but because of the righteousness of Tamar, he is not deceived. She looks him straight in the eye, and she makes a demand. I want you to marry me. And why? She says, you know what I want you to do? I want you to spread your wings over me. What is she saying? It's not enough for you to say that God should spread your wings over me. If you think that I'm good enough for God to spread his wings over me, then you have to be the one to spread his wings over me. What is Judaism all about? It's not just about hakara. It's not just about recognizing imbalances. It's not just recognizing your moral obligations to another person. That's all in the head. It's about action. It's about love. There is another step after hakara, and that step is chesed. Hakara leads to chesed. If hakara gets stopped short, if recognition stops short before chesed, it is disembodied. It is short-circuited. Hakara recognizes a relationship, and then the question is, what are you going to do about it? Will you act on that? The convert says yes. The lover says yes. The Baal Chesed says yes. Boaz hasn't said that yet. Boaz has recognition. He's the child of Peretz, but he doesn't have chesed. She has chesed. What she says to him is, I want you to have something of what I have. I need something from you. You've recognized who I am, but now you have to act on that. If you think it's good enough for God, it's good enough for you. You have to spread your wings over me. And he says, you know what? You're right. Your second chesed is even greater than your first chesed. And he sees to it that he does. And now, what is the story Ruth really all about? Listen to the story from the beginning. Once upon a time, there was a man named Elimelech. Now, the sages tell us that Elimelech was a very rich guy. He was, as a matter of fact, one of the richest guys in the land, and he was from Beit Lechem. Problem was that there was a ra'av ba'aretz. There was a famine in the land. So Elimelech left Beit Lechem. How come Elimelech left Beit Lechem? He's the richest guy. Even the richest guy are not so adversely affected by downturns in the economy. You're the richest guy around. The sages say the reason why he left is because he didn't want everyone coming begging at his door. So he figured he would preserve his wealth by going to Moab. Okay? What happened is, we're in Beit Lechem, and there's no more lechem left in Beit Lechem. There's no more bread left in Beit Lechem. There's a rav. So he exits Elimelech. There's a problem here. What's the problem? Listen to the name Elimelech. What does the name Elimelech mean? Contraction of two words. Elimelech. What does that mean? My God is my king. What is that all about? Recognition. This is Mr. Recognition. He recognizes that God is your king as a recognition of a reality. The problem is that he recognizes everything. He's got his eye on the situation. He understands everything. But what is he missing? Chesed. He doesn't act upon what he knows the reality of the situation to be like. And he does not take care of those who he could take care of. And he leaves and he exits stage left. Now guess what? He has two children, and what are they named? Oh my goodness, they are named Disease and Destruction. What awful names. Well, it's no coincidence. Why do you think Elimelech has two children, Disease and Destruction? Because Elimelech is doing just fine on the Hakara front. He can recognize things, but there's a problem with Elimelech. He can't take it to the next level. He can't do chesed. And recognition without chesed withers on the vine. If you can't bring the natural fruits of recognition of an imbalance in the relationship of your obligations towards another, towards actually giving what that other needs, then that will wither on the vine. It's like a teacher who is full of teaching but can't teach. The wisdom withers on the vine. You can't do it. It needs its natural outgrowth. If you can't express hakara and chesed, it's dead. And this hakara is dying. It gives birth to disease and destruction. Elimelech's line, both spiritually and genealogically, is only a breath away from extinction. These two children are dead, but they're not dead completely. It is possible to resuscitate them. Kilion dies. Orpah goes out. All hope for Elimelech and his line, and the line of Peretz, the royal line of kingship,
now resides in one person, resides in the living dead of Mahlon. Can Mahlon be redeemed? Enter Ruth, a Moabite girl. It falls to her to perform Yibam. A Moabite girl. Isn't that interesting? Now we meet not the line of Judah and Tamar, but we meet Lot and his daughters. Moab. Who is Moab? Remember, how did Moab get born? Through an act of incest. You know what incest is known in the Torah as? Chesed. Chesed gone awry is incest. And it was chesed gone awry. Who was Lot? He was Mr. Love, Lot, wasn't he? Oh, he took care of those guests, didn't he? He wouldn't let anybody do anything. He was so attentive to those needs of the guests. He is just all flowing loving kindness, Lot. And he was, because he got saved from this great cataclysm. He was the Abraham example. Just like Abraham, he entertained those guests. But it wasn't just like Abraham. It was broken chesed. It was imitated chesed. Because the same man who entertains the guests throws his daughters out to the mob and says, whatever you want to do with them is fine by me. He has just enough chesed to squeak by, a terribly impaired vision of chesed. And the two daughters that then have incest with him, name their children after the act of incest, Ammon and Moab, because this is their relationship with their father. Who is this man? A man who is not protective towards his daughters, a man who allows himself to violate his own daughters. He's actually a man who has chesed and no hakara. That's who he is. He's a man who has plenty of love to go around, but no boundaries, no understanding of who this other person is in relation to me. He's my daughter. You're their protector. You're not a consumer. No, he has no understanding of his actual relationship with her. No hakara of you are here and I am here and this is the bounds of our relationship. It's pure love. Incest is love. It's crazy. It's love without boundary. That's what it is. Love without appropriate boundaries is terribly destructive and consuming. And that is Lot. He's love, all right. He squeaks by. He doesn't get destroyed with Sdom. Sdom is anti-love. He's love. But it's love without boundaries. Love without hakara. What does that give birth to? It gives birth to a nation of Moab. What does Moab dedicate themselves to? No love. An inversion of love. Remember we talked about this. Who is Moab? Moab are the people that what do they do? That what are the Jews? The Jews are Rahman and Baishanim Gomle Chasadim. The Jews are compassionate and they have a sense of sexual modesty. There's two kinds of love. There's private love and there's public love. Private love is sexuality. Public love is chesed. If you understand those differences, then you have it in order. What am I? I am Rachmanim, I'm compassionate. Compassion has two offspring. One offspring is Baishanim, a sense of sexual modesty. The other offspring is Gomle Chasadim. I am a Gomel Chesed. What does that mean? The two offsprings of compassion are public love and private love. If I have it all together, I keep public love public and I keep private love private. I am a Baishan. I'm embarrassed about sexuality. I don't flaunt it in public. I understand it's in the private realm I'm not embarrassed. I can show it in the private realm. But I am embarrassed when I take something treasureful that belongs in the private realm and show it in the public realm. And that's what tzniut is all about. That's what sexual modesty is about. It's not about being, prude, having no sense of sexuality. You have a great sense of sexuality, but you understand its preciousness and you express it in private relationships, not in public. Now, I'm a great lover, but not that way. I'm a lover publicly in chesed. I attend to other people's needs. That's what I have. Moab has it all wrong. The victims of incest, the victims of broken love, how do they relate to love? How do they relate to chesed? These guys whose father threw them out to the mob to entertain their guests, how do they relate to chesed? You know what they do? They dedicate themselves to no chesed. When the Jews come to ask them, right, what would you be if you were like that daughter? Would you want to have 13 guests at your Shabbos table if you were that daughter? No. What do you remember chesed as? What do you remember the guests at your Shabbos table? The guests were the guests that my father took care of while he threw me to the mob. I am not going to sacrifice that kind of love for what really counts. They dedicate themselves to anti-love. The Jews come, please can we have some water, please can we have some bread on the way? No, they will not take care of them in the desert. The Jews can find their own water, they can find their own bread. We're not interested in the chesed, we're Moab. On the other hand, what do? They relate to the Jews improperly sexually. Right? The daughters of Moab and Midian go out and are mezana, entice them as a way of weakening the Jews. So what happens is that the private sexuality becomes public. Chesed is topsy-turvy. There is no public chesed. That remains private, just for us. But the private type of chesed, yes, with that will relate to you. It's a topsy-turvy world. This is the legacy of broken kindness. But along comes Ruth. And who is Ruth? A woman from Moab. a woman from this world of topsy-turvy chesed. And what does she do? She devotes herself to true chesed. What she is, she lives for chesed the way it must be lived, both in its sexual form and in its public form. She is the balas chesed. She is the loyalty in her sexual relationship and in her relationship towards others, towards Naomi, to do it right. She is chesed the way it must be lived. What do you have here? You have Elimelech and Mahlon and Kilion, men with hakara, men with recognition, but with no chesed. And that dies on the vine, and it's almost over, except there is a woman that can reignite it, a woman who can import chesed from outside, from the fields of Moab. She can bring chesed. And it's a great act of redemption for her to bring chesed, because she's going against her whole family legacy. She's redeeming her whole family legacy and bringing chesed into the world in the way it must be. And she then unites with Boaz. And she has one question for Boaz. She says, Boaz, you know what? You've got a lot of hakara. You understand who I am. You think God should act to me in a certain way. You're a great intellectual. But what are you going to do about this? What about me? I have a need here. Will you fulfill it? She lays the challenge of chesed at his door. And when Boaz answers, yes, I will do it, then a child is conceived. And the flame that was dormant of Mahlon's life is reignited. The line of the Davidic dynasty is kept alive because Hakara has united with chesed. Ruth has taught Boaz something and has brought chesed back into this family. And now the line can continue because it has been actualized not just physically, but spiritually as well. The Hakara has now blossomed into what Hakara needs to be, chesed. The stories of Lot and his daughters have finally come together with the stories of Yehud and Tamar. The stories of Yehuda were the stories of Peretz, the birth of Peretz, and the birth of Peretz was the act of great moral heroism, was a great act of Hakara. The stories of Lot and his daughters was an act of flawed chesed, but at least it was chesed. Now those two stories come together, and the story of Yehuda and Tamar is incomplete. It is a story of great Hakara, great moral heroism, when Yehuda recognizes the truth about his relationship with Tamar. But Tamar had tricked him, and he had not voluntarily given to her in chesed. It is a story of Hakara, a story of recognition, but not yet a story of chesed. Likewise, the story of Lot and his daughters is incomplete. It too is a flawed story, because the legacy of that broken kindness has been to create a nation that devotes themselves against kindness. Now both of these things will redeem each other. Right? The woman that comes from the nation of flawed chesed will now redeem the line of kingship that comes from flawed Hakara, Hakara that has not reached its potential. And those two come together and ignite the flame of kingship. And their child is a man by the name of Oved. And what does Oved mean? Someone who serves God. What does it mean to have someone who serves God? It means both Hakara and Chesed that have come together. To serve God means that you not just you recognize God, but you act, you serve Him, you bring that recognition into action. It is Hakara plus Chesed together. And Oved gives birth to Yishai, and Yishai gives birth to David. What it means to be king is to be able to bring those two together. And that, I think, is what the triumvirate of these three stories, how they come together. Lot and his daughters, Yehuda and Tamar, and Ruth. Thank you. This concludes Lest It Come to Scandal, the Genesis of Jewish Kingship, from Lot and his daughters to Judah and Tamar and the Book of Ruth. If you've enjoyed this series and would like to find out about other such tapes, please log on to www.jewishexplorations.com. There, you'll find a full catalog of current tapes, as well as the opportunity to listen to audio samples or to purchase tapes online. You can also reach Jewish Explorations by phone, toll-free, at 1-866-JEWISH-EXPLORATIONS. That's 1-866-539-4743.